Hey, confessional listeners. You may be wondering right now, why is there a sports podcast in the confessional feed this week? Well, here's why. Steroids. Each week on the confessional, my guests tell me about a moment in their life when they were at their worst, something they did or said for which they feel deeply ashamed, something that, were this the only thing you ever knew about them, and let's say you learned about it in 160 characters on Twitter, you'd think they were beyond redemption. But I don't leave it there. So we talk about systemic or familial or mental health or addiction factors that contributed to them doing the horrible thing. We talk about what they learned as a result of doing the horrible thing, how they are making it right, and who they are now. In other words, I want their stories to breathe, because by doing so, and by allowing myself to look at the complexities, I find a place of compassion and understanding. And I want compassion and understanding just slightly more than I want the sugar high of self-righteousness. Which brings me to Crushed, a new podcast from Religion of Sports and PRX, in which veteran sports writer Joan Neeson tells about how she fell in love with the sport of baseball in the 90s, only to have her heart broken by the steroid scandal, and how she's now digging into the complexities and letting the story breathe so she can think of her first love with understanding and maybe even compassion again. I'll be back next week with an original episode of The Confessional. But until then, enjoy Crushed, Season 1, Episode 1.
In all great love stories, there's a point, early on, of total euphoria, when everything seems perfect. Maybe you feel that way for a day, a week, a month, completely out of your mind. For me, that feeling lasted an entire summer. I was 10, and the object of my obsession was baseball. When you love a sport the way I loved baseball, you know exactly when you got hooked. The year, the game, maybe even the exact play. You remember it in slow motion, the light, the colors, the sounds. In my story, that moment came on September 8th, 1998, a Tuesday night, in my hometown, St. Louis.
A gorgeous night for baseball. Very hot.
My favorite player, Mark McGwire, was one home run away from breaking the most sacred record in sports.
Wondering if this is the at-bat that Mark McGwire moves one place in front of Roger Maris.
I was at a friend's house that night, and we were glued to the TV. I was sitting on a toy rocking horse, which looked like something from a carousel, white and pink, with a gold pole I held onto while I swayed back and forth, praying for a home run. And then...
down the left field line! Is it enough? Gone! There it is! 62!
I jumped off the horse, threw my arms in the air. The horse rocked forward, then back, and the pole smacked me square in the mouth. I tasted something chalky. A sliver of my front tooth had chipped off. But I couldn't have cared less.
And you will all know where you were at 8:18 p.m. Central Time, September 8, 1998.
My tooth still has that chip. My dentist tried to fix it. I wouldn't let him. It's my own weird way of remembering the day I loved baseball the most, the purest moment of my life as a fan, before things got complicated. Here's the other thing about love stories. The euphoria never lasts. When I was fresh out of school and interning at the Dallas Morning News, I got the assignment of my dreams. The Cardinals were playing in the World Series against the Texas Rangers. I'd never covered the postseason before, so I followed other writers around the park, then down to the diamond for batting practice. I scanned the field, and there he was, not 5 feet from me, McGwire. He was back in baseball as the Cardinals' hitting coach. His once orange goatee was graying, and his towering frame had softened at the edges. I was in awe. But at that moment, You couldn't have paid me $1 million to admit I still felt that way.
I apologize to everybody in Major League Baseball. My family. Today was the hardest day of my life.
That's McGuire on national television when he finally admitted to using anabolic steroids. But it was really just a formality. We already knew. My favorite player had cheated. My favorite sport had let it happen. And the moment the scandal was at its very worst, that's when I got hooked. I'm Joan Neeson. I've spent the past decade working as a sports writer, and I live by the golden rule of the job. No cheering in the press box. But this story, it's personal. It's about more than cheating in sports. It's about feeling cheated. It's about a memory I want to cherish, but just can't. And I know I'm not the only one. A generation of fans flocked to baseball during the steroid era. And now we're left with what, exactly? Our love of baseball is built on a major league lie. But somehow, when I think back to 1998, I still get goosebumps. How do I explain that, knowing everything I know? Should I be embarrassed? Ashamed? Because here's the thing. The magic of the home run race, it helped set me on the path to becoming a sports writer. But I never imagined I'd be investigating that summer for all the reasons it went wrong and all the lives it upended. But that's what I'm here to do, to understand how baseball got hooked on drugs and whether it's ever recovered. This is a story about the legacy of a scandal. This is Crushed.
So this is a tribute and just how I remember 1998.
That's Frank Cusimano, a longtime sportscaster at KSDK in St. Louis. I grew up watching him.
There's my media pass.
Oh, my gosh.
Over here, we have this great picture of McGuire and Sosa together.
He's giving me a tour of his basement, which is basically a shrine to the 98 season.
I think I had that 62 newspaper cover. It was like on a T-shirt, and I owned that T-shirt, I remember. Super fashionable. Great style in fifth grade.
I don't know if you want to get into this, but sometimes when I look at those photos, it's almost like a man looking at wedding photos in a marriage where he eventually found out that his wife was unfaithful to him. You realize there was something wrong with it.
However we feel about it now, 1998 was a huge season for baseball. A comeback from the brink of disaster. Just 4 years earlier, players and owners had been locked in a bitter dispute. The sport was making more money than ever, and players wanted a bigger slice of the pie. By August of 1994, baseball was on strike, and people were pissed.
Man, I think it stinks. I mean, they're already making enough money.
I think the whole thing's a result of obscene pursuit of wealth.
It's really not our pastime anymore.
The World Series was canceled. The next season, delayed. And when baseball returned, some fans swore off the sport. Attendance dropped 20%. But the damage was temporary. Something was happening on the field. Something powerful. For the first time in decades, it looked like the single-season home run record, Roger Maris's 61, might fall.
Baseball was dying because of the work stoppage. All of a sudden, they come back gangbusters. They get 100% of their audience back. So think about it. I mean, the record was 1961, and all of a sudden, in 98, all those years later, you got guys who could do it. Yeah, it was appointment television.
In Seattle, there was Ken Griffey Jr. In Chicago, Sammy Sosa. And in my hometown, we had McGuire.
It was incredible theater every time you saw him. You know, it was a time where the Cardinals were not winning, but it was so electric, so invigorating. It was a jolt of energy that this city and town desperately needed.
There was nothing to look forward to with those Cardinals teams. The team was pretty terrible.
That's my younger brother, John. He definitely has the best podcasting voice in the family.
What did he do in the first game of 98? He did something ridiculous.
Yes, he hit a grand slam on opening day.
It's a grand slam.
And that was like that kind of thing where you just go, something's happening.
Yes, they love him here.
He made you care about baseball on a Tuesday evening at 9 o'clock against the Pittsburgh Pirates, even though the game was meaningless. But he really dictated the way you ate your dinners, the way you conducted your social life, even the way you went to your bathroom. I mean, you did not go to the restroom when Mark McGwire had a chance to bat that inning.
In St. Louis, we weren't used to making national headlines, especially not good ones. And then came McGwire. He made the game fun again, and he was the epitome of what a baseball star should be. Humble, hardworking, wholesome, the whole shebang.
Mark McGwire is a true American hero.
He looked the part, too. Tall, brawny, with short red hair and action figure biceps.
Women found him appealing.
Oh, he's gorgeous. He's cute.
You know, men were obsessed with the power.
You think Mark McGwire is more interesting than the president?
Definitely.
Yeah, he was God with a small G. You know, a lot of times as sportscasters, you don't get all wrapped up in the game. He was the only one who made you forget your job and get so wrapped up in the moment. I'll tell you a story. It was a trip to Miami late in the year. He had 4 home runs in 2 games. And I was so like flustered on the air, I actually said live on television, it's unbelievable what he's doing. If I had a sister, I would love for him to meet my sister. And after I got off the air, my sister called and said, you know, you do have a sister. In fact, Frank, you have 2 sisters. They would open up the stadium earlier so people could watch batting practice. And I can remember like being completely packed 90 minutes before a game.
People are out here to see him. That's basically why we got our tickets, really.
So those people went out of their way just to watch 20 swings. And man, were they swings. Oh my goodness.
We drove 540 miles to see McGwire, and he's gonna knock one out 540 feet.
I used to get a kick out of watching the opposition in the dugout or while they're playing catch, just helpless and in awe watching BP. And believe me, BP was every bit as intoxicating as the game.
And St. Louis's obsession went well beyond the ballpark. My grandparents lived near McGwire. Every time I went to visit them, my head was on a swivel. I was convinced I'd spot him. It never happened. And for a while, there was a rumor at my elementary school that his son, Matt, might move to St. Louis and enroll in my class. That never happened either. But with McGwire, anything felt possible. He was Paul Bunyan in cleats, a real-life folk hero.
You know, people I'm saying it's bringing the country together. So be it. I'm happy to bring the country together.
I worshipped McGwire. It's not that I wanted to play like he did, and I didn't have a crush on him. I just loved that he belonged to St. Louis, to our team. Here's my brother again.
Baseball in our family is a bit of a religion. I mean, we're like culturally Catholic, but we're definitely religiously Cardinals baseball fans.
That religion was passed down, as most faith is. I inherited it from my dad, who inherited it from his mother, whose family had lived down the highway from St. Louis longer than baseball's been played.
Really, my mother was the big baseball fan.
That's my dad, yes. Tom.
She came from, you know, small town America, and baseball was everything. I mean, she had her own glove, which I still have back there.
I used that glove to play catch with my dad and brother when I was a kid. It was perfectly broken in and just the right size. My grandma grew up on a farm near Doe Run, Missouri, a speed bump of a town about 80 miles south of St. Louis. As a kid in the 30s and 40s, she fell in love with the Cardinals. At 16, she moved to the city to become a nurse. She got married, had her 2 boys, and eventually taught them to play catch. She died young. My dad was 8. She had a brain tumor, and she declined quickly. When she passed away, she left 2 young sons and a husband who could barely pour his own cereal. The boys leaned on family, school, and sports. In 1964, just a year after my grandmother died, the Cardinals, her Cardinals, made the World Series. My grandpa somehow snagged 2 seats for Game 7.
He could only get 2 tickets. He offered my brother the ticket. He said, oh, take Tom, which was nice of him. We were on the last 2 corner seats up in the far left field.
So we were about as far away as you could get. But the Cardinals won. It was amazing.
Baseball helped me understand my dad, gave me a link to a grandma I'd never know. It was family history, and I believed in it.
You were raised in a household where the baseball game was always on. You know, I remember when Mom told me that you used to be back there and you'd turn the sound off and do the announcing, you know, like the announcer, and that you knew every player in Major League Baseball.
I can't remember the first time I watched baseball on TV, but I do know that before I was two, I could pronounce Guerrero, as in Pedro, the all-star outfielder the Cardinals traded for in 1988. My dad got a kick out of that. I always enjoyed going to games, gawking at Fred Bird, the Cardinals' giant, pantsless mascot. But it wasn't until 1998 that I caught baseball fever. Every morning that summer, my brother and I would race from our bedrooms to the kitchen, hurtling down the stairs to fight over the newspaper.
You had to get up first and get to the counter first to get the sports section so you could see all the baseball stats.
I forgot we used to fight over that.
Yeah, there's only one sports section. There's no internet.
Every day, I'd take out scissors, a glue stick, and a spiral-bound notebook. Like any normal 10-year-old girl, I'd carefully trim box scores, stories, and always the little chart in the top right corner of the sports section that tracked the race. While my friends plastered their walls with posters of Nick Carter and sent love letters to Justin Timberlake, I happily pasted a summer's worth of stats into that notebook. And my compulsion didn't stop there. I learned how to calculate pitchers' ERAs by hand and obsessed over exactly what record would keep the Cardinals above 500.
Joan was not a normal child. I would not say that.
In the few hours each day when I couldn't watch baseball, I read about it. I learned about the Babe and Roger Maris, records and perfect games. As I devoured page after page, it seemed like all of history paled in comparison to 1998. This wasn't the baseball of the past. This was my baseball, and it was bigger, louder. It was all about one thing. A home run is born quickly, in a nanosecond. There's the crack of the bat, the collective hush. Will it go? Could it? Cheers grow from a buzz to a rumble to a roar. And for many people, that chaos, there's no greater symphony. But why? What makes the home run so irresistible? I needed to answer that question if I wanted to really understand what happened in 1998. So I went looking for someone who could tell me more about the history of the home run, the mythology, the magic. And I found Bill Jenkinson. He's a baseball historian. And even after writing several books about the home run, he still swoons when I mention it.
I can still remember the thrill that I could hear the sound of the bat. It was one of the most powerful sports experiences in my life.
He's talking about watching the Phillies take batting practice when he was 9 years old.
I watched those guys just slugging the ball in every direction, over the rooftops, over the scoreboards, off the light towers. I was breathless, and I've never gotten past that.
I used to make my dad take me early to watch Mark McGwire hit batting practice. And I mean, you couldn't look away.
I agree, Joan. I had the same experience with Mark. And yes, it was astonishing to watch a human being do what he could do. I think we're just drawn to it. I think all human beings are attracted to power in all its forms. And I think you see it in sports quite a bit. Like, look at Goff. Who are the guys that we like the most? We like the guys that hit the longest tee shots. We really do. You talk about Tiger Woods, you know, his 300-plus yard drives. Who actually talks about who the best chippers and putters are? It comes up, but what gets all the attention?
In football, we remember the quarterbacks with cannons. We watch tennis, and we're awed by fast serves. In hockey, slap shots. In basketball, dunks. But in the pantheon of power, I don't think anything tops the home run. Frank Cusimano agrees.
I mean, there's an infatuation with brute strength and raw power. When you see an exit velocity of 120 miles an hour catching up with a 98 mile an hour fastball, I mean, that's the essence of masculinity.
The physics of a home run seem superhuman. Wood and leather, force, and summer breeze. mere mortals can't dream of having the strength and coordination to clobber a ball like that. And the men who can become baseball gods. None more so than the original home run king.
The Sultan of SWAT!
The King of Crash!
The Colossus of Clout!
Babe Ruth!
The Great Bambino!
That's a clip from The Sandlot. When it came out in 1993, I knew boys who spoke almost entirely in quotes from that movie. And I bring it up here not just because I think it's great, but because it says a lot about what the name Babe Ruth still means to people who love baseball. The story is built on the absurd premise that a kid might go through the first decade of life without knowing a thing about the Great Bambino.
What, were you born in a barn, man?
Yeah, what planet are you from?
The kid only learns about the Babe after he's hit a signed Ruth ball into an off-limits yard. It's a disaster. But then, Ruth comes to one of the boys in a dream and tells him he should do whatever it takes to retrieve that ball.
Kid. There's heroes and there's legends. Heroes get remembered, but legends never die.
The Sandlot is more than just a fun story. It's like an epic ode to baseball history. And Ruth is the god, the legend that hovers over it all.
We have our heroes today, people who dominate their sports, LeBron James and Michael Jordan before him, but no one ever became this all-encompassing godlike figure that Babe Ruth did.
In 1920, he set a new single-season home run record of 54. The guy who got closest to him, he had 19. Ruth broke his own record the next year, then again, 60. And as I spoke with Jenkinson about that record and the Babe's place in history, I noticed he kept coming back to one word. Ruthian.
It's so interesting to me that someone's last name became the gold standard adjective in the sport. Do you know when that entered the lexicon?
I don't know if there's one person who coined it first. Could be. But I've seen it countless times in references all the way back to the 1920s.
With Ruth, it's tough to tease apart the legend and the man, to remember that he wasn't a god. He was as human as the rest of us. Ruth was sent to reform school as a kid, and cheated on both of his wives constantly.
He obviously was an imperfect man. It's hard to blame him when you consider his background and everything that he went through. Some of the things he did were destructive to himself. But in his interactions with other human beings, he was always remarkably kind and generous. And I would like people to know that.
I find this so interesting. I didn't ask Jenkinson about Ruth's character, but he brought it up almost immediately. As if he needed to reassure himself about his hero. Because we all want to believe there's something more to our faith in these people, something virtuous, pure. We want their accomplishments to feel untouchable.
The Sultan of SWAT will forever stand alone as the king of baseball's immortal.
And Ruth did stand alone until 1961. That summer, not one, but two Yankees, Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris, were on pace to break the Babe's record. They played for Ruth's team, played in his shadow. How could they possibly stack up to the greatest of all time and the legends that propped up his memory? Maris won the race, but that impossible standard nearly broke him. He died in 1985, but I did track down Roger Maris Jr.
Seeing your dad hit home runs probably about as good as it gets, you know, because the crowd goes crazy and you watch your dad run around and kind of gives you some goosebumps to watch all that. We grew up in Missouri. Like, I didn't realize the way things were until I actually went to New York and saw just the way he was treated in New York. I mean, he was like a rock star.
That was years after Maris broke the record. It wasn't always that way, especially when he first arrived in New York.
No one really knew who he was at the time. Small town guy, Fargo, North Dakota, comes to New York and then has the audacity to beat Mickey out for the MVP that year.
That was his first season with the Yankees. In the second, he and Mantle chased Ruth.
The majority of the people wanted Mickey, you know, which rightfully so. It's Mickey Mantle. He'd been there and, you know, he had already done some amazing things in New York and he was the golden boy.
Maris felt like he'd never measure up. Unlike Mantle and Ruth before him, he didn't enjoy talking to the media. That led to a difficult relationship with reporters.
He had no breathing room. They were surrounding him the whole time after 4 hours on the ball field. And if he didn't answer all the questions, he was getting bad press. And even if he did answer the questions, he was getting bad press.
A Sports Illustrated story from 1961 told of a conversation Maris had with a writer in Chicago who asked if the slugger really wanted to break Ruth's record. Maris had the presumption to say yes. The writer then pointed out that Ruth had been a great man, as if Maris might reconsider his stance. Instead, he doubled down. "Maybe I'm not a great man," he said, "but I damn well want to break the record." That summer, Maris received hate mail. He got death threats. Eventually, the stress made his hair fall out. He had just turned 27.
What he had to endure that season, it's amazing what he did.
And away it goes. Roger now will go into the record book, but with a footnote that Babe Ruth made his 1927 record within 154 game season. It took Maris 159 games of the expanded schedule to do the same.
As soon as it became clear that Maris might break the Babe's record, the commissioner proposed adding an asterisk to the books. He never did, but that intention speaks volumes. Many people refused to believe that someone so unassuming could topple the Babe from his pedestal. They were desperate to protect a record that loomed larger than any other in sports.
Why do you think fans are always so invested in the home run record? Why do you think that record seems to mean more than other records?
Well, it's the sexiest record in sports. There's nothing harder to do than hit a home run.
So you think it's probably the most difficult record to break then?
Oh, hands down. I mean, no doubt about it.
It took 34 years for Maris to pass Ruth, another 37 for McGuire to muscle his way to the top. For each of the home run kings, the record took hundreds of thousands of swings, years of training. For Maris, the record was worth sacrificing sanity, calm, his appearance. For McGuire, it was worth breaking the law, and who knows how many shots to the butt. And why not? Most players would do anything to hit like that, to draw millions of eyes and thousands of flashbulbs with every swing. And in the 90s, a lot of them did. In 1998, it wasn't just McGuire who was chasing baseball immortality. That June, Cubs outfielder Sammy Sosa hit 22 home runs in 27 games. The home run race was on.
I've never seen a more amazing sporting achievement than those guys going after that 61. You turn on the TV, it was the lead story. If you looked in the newspapers, the lead. If you went to the water fountain at work, you talked about it. Anywhere you went, you were talking about the home run chase of Maris.
On August 19th, McGuire and Sosa faced off at Wrigley Field in a game that captures the thrill of that season in one 3.5-hour burst. That afternoon, the two sluggers were tied at 47 home runs, and their bats stayed quiet until the fifth inning.
So Sosa the batter. He's one for two, and he sends a rocket deep toward left. Back goes Mabry. At the track. At the wall. He's got it. Number 48.
And Sammy, who just missed in the third, puts the Cubs on top by four with his 48th. The fans going crazy here in Chicago.
For the first time all summer, McGuire had lost his lead. And in his next at bat, he didn't get anything to hit. Neither did Sosa. He walked, and his rival waited at first base.
Mark McGuire probably saying to Sammy, "I'm a real big guy. I know how I can hit him, but compared to me, you look like a jockey. How do you hit so many of them?"
Yeah, that's because he's not seeing him without his shirt on too often. Sammy's put together pretty good.
In the top of the eighth, the Cubs led 6-5 when McGuire came to bat. He saw one ball outside the zone, then two.
Crowd booing. They want McGuire to swing the bat. Swung on, belted deep toward left. No doubt about that, baby.
And we are tied at 48 for the home run lead. And the fans who have come here today have gotten their money's worth. And just like that, the game is tied at 6.
Did you notice that? The score was an afterthought. Two division rivals were facing off. The game was tied late, and nobody gave a damn about 6-6. It was 48-48 that mattered. And when the game went to extra innings, McGuire was the second man to bat.
Swung on, belted. In the center field, Judson back at the track. At the wall, McGuire has number 49.
Sosa had led for fewer than three innings, and the race marched on. By the first week of September, McGuire had a cushion, and he was barreling towards 62. Roger Maris Jr. felt conflicted.
You never want to see your dad's record fall. I mean, obviously, it was to me, I think it was one of the greatest records in sports. So you clearly don't want that to happen. But you also realize that records are made to be broken. And now dad said that once. He said it 1,000 times that, you know, I'm just like he broke Ruth's record. And, you know, someday somebody might break his record.
So now we're back to where this episode began, September 8th, 1998. The Cardinals were playing the Cubs, of all teams, in St. Louis. I told you earlier what it was like to live this as a 10-year-old, but when I started working on this podcast, I went back and watched 62 over and over. Here's what it looks like to me now. McGuire's line drive barely cleared the left field fence. Busch Stadium erupted in screams and tears and camera flashes. McGuire was so overwhelmed, he rounded first base without touching the bag.
First, Mark, you are the new single-season home run king!
At every base, McGuire got a high five, a fist bump, a pat on the butt from coaches and opponents. Fireworks exploded overhead. Remember, this is the fourth inning.
Folks, it couldn't happen to a better man.
When McGuire stepped on home, he hoisted his son, Matt, the bat boy, into the air. Next, Sosa trotted in from left field, and McGuire lifted him too. At this point, the game had been stopped for 2 minutes, but the celebration was just getting started. McGuire jogged toward the dugout, then passed it. He jumped into the seats to tearfully hug Roger Jr. and the rest of the Maris family. Then, McGuire grabbed a mic.
All my family, everybody, my son, Chicago Cubs, Sammy Sosa. Unbelievable. Class. Thank you, St. Louis.
Busch Stadium needed more than 10 minutes to collect itself. The rest of the game was an afterthought. And when the final out was called, a press conference began on the field.
I want to thank both Mark McGuire and Sammy Sosa. You have made this a summer that generations will remember.
That's Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig.
To acknowledge Mark for breaking the single-season home run record set by the great Roger Maris, I am honored to present Mark the Commissioner's Historic Achievement Award.
It was basically an invented award, a brand new trophy. Sosa would get one too later that fall. Watching the broadcast now, it's striking how much baseball was looking for something, anything, to hammer that night into history. To say, look, here, at this magical thing we've done, which kind of ruins the magic. Of course, some of the script was outside of the league's control. It couldn't have planned that the Cubs would be in town, that McGuire would be so giddy he'd leap over first base. But that shiny, gold, never-before-seen trophy, it was calculated. So was the Maris' presence. And McGuire milked it for all it was worth.
And it was meant to be, but there was a part of him inside me, and I really hope their family really understood that, that they saw Roger and Mark at the same time.
In retrospect, it all feels like a bit of a reach. Sure, a few coincidences linked the Marises and McGuires, but they were trumpeted on the news like divine revelations, stretched to the point of breaking.
He was born 2 years to the day after Roger Maris hit his 61st home run. A couple of days ago, he hit number 61 on his father's 61st birthday.
And I know that Mark McGuire believes in fate. Roger Maris homered in the fourth inning to break Babe Ruth's mark. Mark McGuire homered tonight in the fourth inning. So he believes that there's some, you know, mystical fate or some God looking down upon him.
Roger Maris broke Babe Ruth's record 15 years after Ruth died. McGuire breaks Maris's record 15 years after Maris dies.
Actually, it was 13 years in both cases. But math was secondary to the narrative that this had all been preordained. That fall, home runs transcended baseball, transcended sports. They even inspired Barbara Walters to recite a poem on air.
He made us all believers in big dreams and in the game. For even though our country changes, baseball stays the same.
The home run race gave us something to rally around at a time when the country was begging for a distraction. See, outside of sports, America wasn't feeling so great about itself in 1998. This was the summer the Clinton Lewinsky scandal unraveled, and news broadcasts toggled between the home run race and the tawdry details of what happened in the Oval Office.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie.
President Bill Clinton was under investigation for having an affair with an intern and lying about it. In fact, just a day after McGuire broke the record, Kenneth Starr delivered his damning report to Congress. He had a case to impeach. So, yeah, America needed a hero. Maybe that's why so many people wanted to believe they'd found one in McGuire, and why no one wanted to admit what was really going on. But that doesn't mean everyone was clueless. And I asked Roger Maris Jr. what else was on his mind back then.
Were you thinking at all about steroids at that point?
I had buddies that were juicing. I had played on the softball circuit where people were juicing. So, yeah, I knew what was going on.
So did you think when you looked at McGuire, like, hey, there's a chance he's doing this stuff at the time? Or was that not quite on your mind that summer?
Oh, it was definitely on my mind, clearly on my mind. But you got to realize, and you were alive at that time, I mean, the story was so big. It was probably the biggest feel-good story of my lifetime, and nobody was going to ruin that story. It was helping baseball. It was great for baseball. It was great for everybody. You felt good. I felt good. Everybody felt good watching what they were doing. So no one wanted to be the guy to come up and go, this is not legit. This is BS, you know, and ruin the feel-good story. We just sucked it up and were like, if this is the new norm, you know, it's the new norm.
Roger Jr. didn't have to ruin the story. Time would play spoiler instead. When McGuire hit his 70th home run on the final day of the 98 season, it seemed as if his record would stand for ages. Unlike Maris, who barely made it past Ruth, Big Mac had demolished the previous record. The numbers seemed freaky, monstrous, inhuman. Because they were. At 10, I had no idea. I was too innocent to question what I saw, to wonder why first basemen suddenly looked like offensive linemen, outfielders like strong safeties. There was no voice in the back of my head to silence, no devil on my shoulder whispering steroids. But for a lot of people, that devil came in the form of Associated Press reporter Steve Wilstein.
You know, when I went into McGuire's locker, I was taking notes about what I saw. And then I saw this little bottle that I didn't know anything about. I wrote it down in my notebook to look it up later and see what it was.
Wilstein had the biggest story of the summer, and no one wanted to hear it. Next time on Crushed, what did we know? When did we know it? And why did we ignore the truth for so long? Crushed is written and reported by me, Joan Neeson. Jessica Popovac is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Devin Manzi, and our production assistant is Megan Coyle. Michael Garofalo is our editor. Jane Ackerman fact-checked the series, and Dan DeZula mixed this episode. Gautam Chopra, Amit Sankaran, and Adam Schlossman are our executive producers. Special thanks to Lisa Pollack and to composer Michael Kramer. Crushed is a production of Religion of Sports and PRX. If you like the show, please follow us and leave us a review wherever you do your listening.